so for this last session, Mike Hudson is going to give us basically a summary and some of his own impressions about what he's heard and what he thinks is interesting. And then I expect each and every one of you to interrupt him and ask questions and spark discussion, because after he's done blabbing, then we're supposed to blab and have a discussion. And basically, that can go as long as we want. Maybe we'll cut it off after an hour or so. And that'll be it. So without further ado, Mike, why don't you...
Thanks. And before I forget, let's thank the organizing committee for organizing this meeting. Otherwise, in the rush at the end, we're all tired and sort of just filter out, right? Okay, so personally, thanks to the organizers for, or maybe, I don't know if I should be thanking you or not for asking me to do this. So these are my own personal thoughts, and they're designed to be a little bit provocative, and feel free to interrupt or interject as I know you will, since that's the tradition here. So I'm going to prime you with some things to think about before we get started, so that if you get bored of listening to me, you can ponder this in the back of your brain and it maybe stimulate some more discussion. So I will talk a little bit about what my impressions were, but I also want to talk about or think about what we didn't talk about. All the good, bad, oops, sorry, let me go there in a second. The good and the bad and the ugly things about astronomy. And this is all coming from my own view as an observer. Okay, so as you all know, this is what observers do. I'm a theoretically inclined observer, and many of you are observationally focused theorists, so we're not so far apart. As you know, we all count stars. In Googling this and trying to find this cartoon, I came across an interesting story that apparently, it was attached to the cartoon for some reason, Kapteyn, the Dutch astronomer who was doing star counts in the galaxy, apparently used prisoners to do some of his calculations and data reduction for him. Luckily, today we've got graduate students, so we don't have to worry about it. So the rest of you, most of you, fall in this category over here of other Harris cartoons, where, as we all know, you mostly write things on the board and skip a few steps and get to the end. Some of you are bridging the gap, and I enjoyed this comment that I heard down here from a theorist moving into observation. So we're all coming together. So as I said, my perspective is more on this side than on that side, and that'll probably come through. So what I want you to think about is, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly of cosmology. Most of the meeting is usually about the ugly. In other words, the little details that we have to worry about, the technical problems that we have to solve, and that's fine. But I like to step back and take a bigger picture and think about, you know, what really excites you about cosmology right now and also going into the future. Okay, so since I'm an observer, you know, a question you might think about is, if you had $1 billion, what would you do with it? Okay. Exactly. More than a fistful, right? So, and not buy more theorists, right? That's the way I see that. What's the best way to tackle the problems in cosmology from a practical perspective? On the other hand, we've had a little bit of discussion about this, but I also want to know what worries you the most. Okay, what keeps you up at night? And so be provocative. You know, go ahead, make my day. So you can interrupt any time, right? This is an open discussion. I'm just going to throw out things, and if you want to chirp in, please be my guest. Okay, so this is my perception of some of the themes of this meeting. Just from a very broad brush perspective, and if you just turned up for this one session, don't think you're going to have an understanding of what happened here. This is just a broad brush overview. So one way of looking at this from an observer's perspective is, this is all about the data, and this is really the death, I would say, of the auto correlation. Okay, because what we heard a lot about were cross correlations of this versus that. right? So densities of things, galaxies or 21 centimeter densities or Lyman alpha fluxes. All these things have been studied to death through the autocorrelation. What we didn't actually hear a lot about, and I'll come back to this, is dark matter from weak lensing. Okay? We also heard about velocities of galaxies or free electrons, if you're talking about the kinetic Sunny of Zeldovich, Lyman alpha gas. All these things cross-correlated with each other, or in particular with the CMB temperatures, foregrounds, and so on. Okay, so it's, and that makes sense, right? Because if you just do autocorrelations of n things, you have only n measurements that you can make. But if you have cross-correlations, you get n times n minus 1 over 2. A lot more pairs, right? So that was fun. And this cross-correlation seems to be exploding, and there are some things we didn't hear about that have been in the literature recently of cross-correlations of lensing maps with CMB maps. Sunyaev Zeldovich signal from the CMB maps with lensing maps and so on and so forth. So it seems to be an explosion in terms of number of things you can cross-correlate with each other in the hope that they'll all build a consistent picture. This was a fun cross-correlation that I liked. It was the one I wasn't expecting. This was shown to us in the talk that focused mostly on cross-correlation of redshifts, but I've taken away the Planck picture, which was in the slide, from this paper by Schmidt et al. It was a cross-correlation of the cosmic infrared background with redshift templates of QSOs. I thought that was kind of cool. And there's the paper reference. So that's a non-standard cross-country, and it's useful for measuring things about the properties of galaxies in this case, but it is still a cross-correlation. That was very nice. Okay, so here are some of the themes of the meeting that we talked about. We spent a lot of time talking about neutrinos, for example. We talked a little bit about kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, and we talked a lot about the gaseous universe, both the IGM, the Lyman alpha forest, and higher redshift, the reionization epoch. And these are all interesting foregrounds in front of the CMB. And of course, there's a lot of theory because this is a theory-heavy place, the power spectra, and so on. So let me say a few impressions about the neutrino aspect. So from my perspective, the good thing about neutrinos is that they're there, and they have mass, right? So it's a good target to go after. It's kind of an easy target, but it's a valid target. It's part of the model. And we heard lots of talks showing how we can measure their mass and even in principle separate the effect of the mass in terms of more than just the depression of the power spectrum, but other techniques, dipole cross-correlation, to separate them from, for example, you can imagine a hypothetical modification to the primordial power spectrum that would, through some coincidence, look like a neutrino signal. So it's kind of interesting that people are thinking about ways of disentangling those things and actually extracting signal from the neutrinos themselves. Of course, the bad is that it's a very small effect, very hard to measure. That could be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your perspective. Right. And the ugly, we heard a lot about how hard it is to simulate all those amazing progress to understand this theoretically or through simulations and the conflicts between those, the new techniques of trying to simulate. Neil Dalal talked about his sort of hybrid fluid particle method, trying to overcome the issues of shot noise with the simulations, and that was very interesting, I thought. Of course, there's other effects, and this reminded me of this plot that was shown in the Inman talk, showing this dipole signal from the cross-correlation of the CDM with the neutrinos, and actually this was swamped by the dipole of the dipolar cross-correlation between the CDM and the dark matter halos, right? Which kind of illustrates some of the messy stuff that you have to understand if you're going to tease out these very, very small effects, that we have to understand how halos form, because we're always going to be using halos in this case to do the tracing. At least that's all that was discussed so far. So is this hopeless? That's a provocative question somebody can answer. Kendrick, is this hopeless? What do you think?
I have to dump my eye.
It's a different signal, right? But maybe this is an artifact of the simulation, right? That shape. I don't think there's a theoretical understanding for where this comes from.
So since none of the people who are involved,
that's
in
true,
this
they're not.
Here,
we can take. We
are
can,
you there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, okay. Yeah. So we get
this confused before long, and now we have still not understand.
Okay, but clearly we're going to have to understand that
yeah.
if we're going to separate these effects.
Okay.
But that's good because that gives us a chance to do more work, right?
Okay.
So maybe it's not a bad thing.
But there is, it actually does go above the dark matter and we go to larger R, right? So
maybe. I don't know.
So
it's kind of noisy.
How far out do you want to go?
Looks kind of noisy. Huh?
Yeah.
If that's from the simulations, right?
Do you remember what is the mass of neutrino here? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We have minutes.
Yeah. I guess the question is this really just for a small, very small mass is the problem, or even for, I guess there isn't really a big range anyway, so.
I think looking at the peak of this single bad part, I think the neutron mass should be 0.05.
But this is the minimum.
Yeah.
That's the lowest you can have, right? If you're in the, not the inverted, the, what's it called? The regular, non-inverted hierarchy, right? So that's the low as we think the neutrino can go from the mass splitting.
It's
a pretty small signal though, right? And I don't have a feeling how these overlay with actual data that you might hope to measure. Whether it's within hope, I don't get of a sense whether it's, you know, how far away in the future are we? Even if we could remove this uncertainty here, is it measurable in the near future? Or do we have to go way into the future to figure this out?
So Bailey thinks optimistically it's measurable. That's based on, I think, the slide.
But Whaley's optimistic to begin with, so it's sort of optimism squared there. Anyway, it's a fun idea. And obviously, it's going to need more work, theoretically, and from simulations to disentangle at least what the theoretical predictions are.
Just out of curiosity, can you do better if you know where to look? I mean, if you kind of roughly know what the neutrino mass is from other features in the power spectrum, maybe you can do a better job for this particular system. It'd be like a corroborating signal.
I guess the feeling is if you change the mass, I guess you have this range of 0.05 to 0.1, this would just probably go up or down. I guess that's probably what's going to happen. Maybe it's going to change shape a little bit, but not quite much. Just it's not a very big range.
That's a pretty flat signal.
Yeah.
But a nice idea. Okay, so neutrinos sound like an interesting area. Kinetic Sinyazeldovich effect, we talked about a little bit. I like it because it's a great way to measure velocities and on large scales. I think you have to do it on large scales effectively because it's so noisy, right? But unlike the classical way of doing velocities, which I'll maybe talk about a little bit later, where on the largest scales we only have one measurement, you know, the bulk flow on the biggest scales that we can probe, in principle, you could measure independent patches. Whether that's possible in practice, I don't know, though. And I'd be interested to know, maybe from experts in the back of the room, could you measure an RMS bulk flow on some large 100-ish megaparsec scales? You get enough signal to noise in independent patches that the RMS from the velocities dominates over the measurement noise from the CMB, background CMB noise, to actually measure something like that. Either of you guys can comment, or both.
One power of CMB temperature, one power of velocity, and one power of density field. And you can factor that three-point correlation in different ways, like the way an annual I do it, or our KSC analysis is we think of building a template out of delta and V across correlating with T. But you could also think of the same three-way correlation as taking T and delta.
Okay, just multiplying T and delta.
You take the C and the map, you take some estimate of the density field, spectroscopic.
Yeah.
And then cross correlate them to get some estimate for the radial velocity in the region. As for signal to noise, well, the total signal to noise of the three-point function measurement is unchanged regardless of how you factor it. So a futuristic experiment that gets a 20 sigma KSC detection, say, would get some sort of noisy reconstruction of the velocity field on large scales with the total signal to noise of around 20.
So theoretically, it might be possible. Right. So what limits it ultimately? Is it angular resolution, or how do you improve over what we have right now? If you wanted to do that measurement better, is it limited by the foreground reconstructed density field? Probably limited by your measurement of the CMB, and the only way you can make that better is to get better angular resolution.
For now, at least, the limiting factor is still measurement from the CMB, and that's just CMB primary fluctuations and detecting noise. In the future, though, detecting noise won't be the limiting factor, and we're almost there, because if you want to get any signal at all from the KSZ, you have to look on scales that are at least as big as your clusters. And there, it turns out, most of the noise is due to just CMB primary fluctuations. So removing those CMB primary fluctuations is hard, given that they have the same frequency spectrum as your KSZ. There's a possibility to reduce them by, say, 20% if you include polarization data, just because modes and temperature are correlated by up to 20%. So if you subtract your polarization data to your temperature map, you remove 20% of that noise. But ultimately, it looks like that will be the dominant source of noise.
So of course, you guys are using clusters, right? But you could use like NIOSH and I and Guillaume tried. You could, in principle, use everything, right? And most of the momentum, since the velocities are all about the same, the momentum is mostly out of the clusters because they don't contain most of the mass. They do have the advantage they're easy to find, right? So
I think they use all the galaxies in some sample, right? What is the LRG sample?
Right now we're using all the CMS.
Okay, so that's a kind of a hybrid, yeah. They're not rich clusters, they're sort of groupy things, right?
But I suppose if you have more galaxies, that's another way to go.
Yeah, it's definitely better. And people are also doing it not by just looking at cluster by cluster, but trying to reconstruct the linear density field and the linear velocity field and have a continuous map that would be your KSZ template.
But I mean, it doesn't even have to be linear density field, it could be the nonlinear density field. I mean, on a small scale, there probably there's a lot of signal, density is nonlinear.
But so in terms of just sophistication of the templates, this is things that people are working on. There's a group with Ben Level in France, as well as the Nancy Escher and Van Delft group, who are making these kind of templates that are trying to be more sophisticated.
Yeah, they're reconstructing.
We are at the BMW group.
Maybe we're all in the same group, I don't know. Of course, the other nice angle about the KSZ is it's a way to find the baryons, right? At least the baryons that are electrons, that are ionized, right? And to build a good template, and I'll come back to that in a second, of course, you want to know how everything's correlated, right? So we just talked about this. It's a small signal, hard to separate. You had 4 sigma, which is great, if that holds up. So that's good, and it could be improved, as was described. And the ugly part, if we want to improve this, is that the velocities and the profile of the electrons are going to get mixed up at some level. And that's either, like all the ugly things, that's either a bad thing or a good thing, depending on your point of view. If you care about this, maybe the template of the electrons around mass over densities is something that's a nuisance for you. On the other hand, it tells you some astrophysics, which is interesting, right? You kind of have to know what the cross correlation is, what the profile is, the mean distribution of your electrons around the things that you're using to trace the density field. And that gets even harder when you get up to higher redshifts, when you're thinking about KSE at reionization, and there's these big patches, these bubbles that we heard about. I would imagine that's even less certain, because it's going to depend on exactly how the reionization proceeds, right? So in that case, you've got some bubble template superimposed on some overdensity template, so some kind of weird convolution like we were talking about before.
Although I guess I would argue that, for understanding the same baryons and reionization, we're doing kind of qualitative, more astrophysical questions. And
yeah.
So there, that's what you're trying to measure.
Sure.
So
that's
what you're learning.
You're interested in this more than that,
yeah.
In some sense, right? That's the goal.
For the KSC, you can look at larger scales, and then you're okay. You can separate the small scale physics.
Mm-hmm. Right, as we heard. Right.
No, but signal is on a small scale. You don't have much signal on larger scales.
Yeah, but the measurements of the KSC, or at the power spectrum level, the detection for SPT is at LM3000, which is still pretty large scale compared to galactic scales.
Is there a detection from SPT?
Yeah, there is a detection, kind of.
okay.
It depends. There's this CIB-TSC correlation that makes it hard, but then they try to separate that out with three-point function and then they claim.
Because I keep telling me, Gil Hoyle keeps telling me that they keep looking at it, they don't find any KSC, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, the KSC is uncomfortably small.
Yeah.
That they're finding. But because of you have the primary CMB and then you have all of the point sources, and so you're kind of limited, at least at the power spectrum level.
But do you have a sense of what a scale actually contributes to that?
Well, it depends on redshift, but most of the KSC comes from high redshift. So, and this is much different from what Kendrick and
But the highest beam redshift of 2 or redshift of 6, which one are you?
Yeah, so, of course, tau electron scattering goes is 1 plus e the 3 halves, but then density is growing. So I think the kernel peaks at redshift 3, but it's very broad.
I see. Okay, so you think these are still linear scales?
But then you have patchy reionization.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a complicated question.
But yeah, as you were saying, the patchy reionization is what you're after.
Yeah, the problem, I guess, is probably the power spectrum is really, information is very hard to extract from just the power spectrum. So you really need to do cross-correlation, something like that. And I guess maybe if you have traces, and basically the same thing that Emmanuel and Kendrick did at redshift, 0.5, you could do it at redshift 3, I guess that would be nice.
That seems very hard to do at redshift 3, so.
You need just a lot of galaxies.
Or somehow use a lineup of force.
Right, that's not
Any other comments about KSC before we move on?
It's actually the 20 sigma that you mentioned. So what sort of galaxy survey were you thinking about?
Oh, that was the number. That number is not super meaningful.
But redshift range, are we thinking? Are you thinking of Vesta 1 or even higher redshift?
Isn't that roughly with
And the improvement just comes from noise and combination of noise and angular resolution of some kind, or
the signal to noise.
Yeah, the improvement in the signal to noise is due
just number of objects. So the 4 sigma we have now is with 30,000 galaxies, which is really small compared to the hundreds of thousands of CMS galaxies that there are. So already this is an improvement. And then, of course, you should lower your detector noise and increase your resolution. But mostly for now, it's number of objects.
So it's a template, not the CMB.
So number of objects
when I say number of objects that overlap with our CMP map. So the limiting factor is our CMP map being small.
I see. Okay. Area, then. Area, sky coverage.
Yeah.
Sky coverage.
So that's the thing about cross-correlation is that you can improve either by improving either of the things across
Exactly.
So maybe before we move on, I'll mention something that I'm personally excited about with respect to KSC. So if you look at the density fluctuations on very large scales in the universe, you know, we see one particular realization, and so in effect that is a non-stochastic fixed background that the other stuff lives in. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you want to probe that with things like CMB, you're completely swamped by cosmic variance because you're looking at the largest scales. But KSC does something kind of neat, which is that long wavelength stuff modulates the power of KSC. And so KSC tomography is actually a really interesting tool for studying large horizon scale physics in a way that's not cosmic variance limited, but actually like limited by our ability to do KSC well. So systematics and foregrounds and all this other stuff that you could possibly make progress on. So I think it's an interesting opportunity that should be explored. What kinds of early universe physics could be remapped to L of 10,000 where you could actually see something.
So are you imagining in terms of larger scale, long wavelength density modes, or like some sort of coherent larger scale structure?
Like, yeah, anything that you don't have in a horizon volume, any realization, so that it is in effect a stochastic random field because it's sampled differently in many places. So I don't know exactly where the cutoff is for that, but you know, stuff that varies on gigaparsec scales. So you could look, you know, why is the CMB quadrupole weirdly low? Maybe you could try and understand that question better.
But you're still cosmic variance limited. It's just you have more, instead of a surface, you have a volume, but still one universe. Right?
Sure, but it's cosmic variance that you get from looking for a power asymmetry where the power is peaking at L of 10,000, not looking at stuff that's, you know, you've got like two modes. You've got however many modes that you have, that, you know, that however many clusters you have, it's like that's your statistic now. That's the cosmic variance limit. It's not us, right? It's like you've got now billions of observers, not one observer here on Earth. Billions of observers scattered throughout the universe.
If you're asking about the velocity field on like 10 gigaparsec scales, though, there's still some limit to how well you can look for an anomaly.
Well, that's part of it, right? I mean, you could, in principle, use this to probe the Gaussian fluctuations on those large scales, because, in effect, those aren't really stochastic, because there's, you know, one enormous mode. There's not many modes that are sampled differently in different parts.
So is this a bit like, you know, people have argued that we don't live in a giant void, for example, because then the stuff that's on the edge would be moving out at high velocity and would be above the CMB limits. Is that the sort of thing you're thinking of?
Sure, that's a constraint on what the universe looks like on the larger scales.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a way that breaks the degeneracy that's imposed by the fact that the CMB is just a projection.
Cool. Okay, so there's a few things I didn't hear as much about. That I thought I would, because here we are at perimeter, right? So we didn't hear much about non-Gaussian,
except Sarah did
talk about it. I think you were the, and there was a, Yassine mentioned it briefly, but that was in the speed segment of your talk, so it kind of went mostly over my head. Some FNLs flashed by, and that's all I saw.
I missed the colloquium,
yeah, that's right. I was trying to write this up. Okay, there was more non-Gaussianity in the colloquium. Has non-Gaussianity gone out of fashion, or just people don't know what to do with it, or what's the story there? It used to be a popular thing, or it had its little blip of popularity. And did maybe Kendrick killed it? I don't know.
It was joint work with the Brandon version
name. So are you the good or the bad or the ugly then?
I think it's going to take, I mean, it is true. probably fewer talks on it post-Planck, simply because the Planck constraints are pretty good. It's going to take a while for the electrical structure to improve them.
Yeah. But there's all these big surveys coming up, right? So I guess one of them will set better constraints than what Planck has done.
Yeah, the forecasts for experiments like LSST and Euclid are a little bit better than Planck.
A little bit better, but not orders of magnitude better.
But it's 21 centimeters, 7 as opposed to 2x. Right.
Right. First, we have to see the 21 centimeter.
Yes, so.
I'm sure it's out there. Whether we'll detect it, we'll see. So that was one thing. So some of these things are just things that I'm curious about because I haven't heard much about them, and I kind of wonder what's the status of topic X, you know, from an observer. The ISW, didn't hear much about that either. Somebody, we were chatting about this, and maybe this is the reason it's not so popular, is that somebody said Crittenden calculated that with the ultimate ISW survey, with all the imaginable amount of data, that you would only get an 8 sigma detection. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's why that, you know, aside from detecting it, you want to use it to measure something. And if the best you can do is 8 sigma, then maybe it's not so interesting. You can object to that if you want. No. And then way back when we were also discussing this at dinner last night, there was a factor of 2 in this, I think it was a Ho paper, I can't remember the year. Did that go away? What happened to that?
So regarding what?
Factor of, so this paper, my recollection of it is they cross-correlated with a whole bunch of different foreground tracers of the ISW. And they sort of, each one gave a slightly different measurement of the ISW signal compared with what you would expect in Lambda CDM, for example. So in their notation, in the paper, they had a parameter A, which was 1 if it was Lambda CDM. And the measurement, if I recall, was 2 plus or minus 0.3 or something like that. So it was nominally, or maybe 0.4, sort of a 2.5-3 sigma measurement that was higher than you expected. And I haven't heard anything else much about this topic since then. I'm hoping some expert can tell me whether this went away. I guess Ho isn't, she was supposed to be here, I guess. She
couldn't make it.
Couldn't make it, okay. So, does anybody know what happened to that factor? Have we just forgotten about the ISW?
There's a Planck ISW paper, but I don't think any of the discrepancies have been large enough for people to do the sleepover. So, for some reason, maybe that was an anomaly.
Okay.
Yeah, my recollection of the history is that it's always been high at 2 sigma, but with a very time-dependent error bar.
Uh-huh. So it's always 2 sigma, but it approaches 1 asymptotically.
The very first detection was 3 plus or minus 1 times the signal.
Okay.
And then I think from this Ho et al. Paper, it's 2 plus or minus 0.5, roughly.
Okay.
Now it's 1.4 plus or minus
0.2. I see. So some kind of convergence then. In some sense. All right, so we'll leave the ISW behind. Didn't hear anything about substructure or missing satellites or warm dark matter or all that good stuff.
Those are small scales.
They're small scales. Did we ask? We did say large scale structure. It's true. It's true. So these, I guess, continues to be in the status that it was before. And the most surprising thing, since we're at perimeter, I don't think we heard much about any kind of modified gravity models. The feeling I got was everybody's bought into the Lambda CDM picture, and it's just a question of, you know, if you want to tweak it with a little something or not.
Sorry, what did you say, Richard?
I haven't bought into
that. You haven't bought into
it. Okay.
So
what's the alternative, and how do we check for it, since I'm an observer, right?
Degeneracy, I have to admit, the
refuse to believe that there actually is a very cosmological constant that's not small. That's just if that's the way the universe is.
So that's what keeps you up at night, then.
Sorry?
Resign. That's the way.
That's not the kind of universe you want to live in.
Yes, that's not the kind of universe I want to live in.
Is that a bad or an ugly?
It's ugly.
Ugly can be good because ugly is intriguing, right?
The universe without Richard is not the good
thing. Yeah, ironically, it seems to be also what the particle theory is converging to, too. The data is right on the line with the standard model. Mm-hmm. It has such terrible fine tuning problems as the worst fine tuning problem. I think we're wrong about how we can fine tune it.
Maybe.
So,
I hope it doesn't get like particle physics.
So I have a
size of the group.
Yes, the sociology is heading in that direction, definitely. 1,200 people on Euclid, I think.
So there is there is probably something that maybe we I'm not sure whether it's a good analogy, but it's certainly something we can compare. I mean, our hierarchy problem with the particle physics hierarchy problem. So there they do have targets. Which is, I guess, like you want to solve the hierarchy problem, so you have supersymmetry or maybe large extra dimension. So there are some candidates that may have their own problems, but then they are really built to address the hierarchy problem. And so they have things that they could test for and rule out. So somehow in cosmology, we haven't really done that, or we just randomly modify gravity in arbitrary ways.
That's my perception as an observer, but
and
you know, we add this extra little term that isn't already excluded.
Speaking as somebody who's not an observer, looks at it from the point of view of quantum gravity, I would say the sort of obvious thing is gravitational vacuum polarization. Mm-hmm. So we know that right now I can see you more or less clearly, and the reason why is my glass is polarized, and that changes the optical properties of the light. The same thing goes on in gravity. And if you have a density of stuff available, well, one thing that we know, if we believe in primordial inflation, is that there is a vast, beyond imagining, ensemble of infrared particles that got created. And unless the universe just exactly ended, so that the next, so that if we hadn't been inflating right now, we would not see any more things re-entering the horizon because there just weren't any. And there's a vast ensemble of them that are still super horizon. It stands to reason that they're going to do something, and what they would do would be do something on the largest possible scales, right? This is not very hard to understand, and so I would say that that's the prime place to expect an input from deep theory to give a modified gravity.
Good, because that'll come back later.
But you do expect, but do we get, have we seen anything? I mean, there has been a lot of expectation, but has theory fulfilled that expectation?
Well, theory hasn't made any predictions right now.
But that's the problem, right? Yeah.
Because I don't know how to make predictions about that situation. I think we ought to think about how to make predictions about that. So the question is dead easy to formulate. Suppose we're in an ensemble of gravitons, very long wavelength gravitons. They're going to do, there are sort of the evil, or let's see, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The very bad, who just argue that zero is what happens. That, I think, is so much nonsense that can't possibly be true. It does do something. It may be small, but it does do something. How do we calculate what the something is, and what kinds of effects would we expect coming from a vast ensemble of super horizon gravitons, let's say, that we're sure that those got produced, probably other particles.
That's the one of the problems is that there's not well-defined models with well-defined predictions.
Well, this is even
right?
A classical general relativity problem. I know how to think about it in electrodynamics. I don't know how to think about it very well in gravity. You could ask the same question of suppose you're in an ensemble of dust. It's going to slightly modify interacting dust that interacts with gravity. It's going to slightly modify the gravitational properties of the universe that you perceive. How is it going to do that? What it makes my head hurt even trying to think about that, but there must be some some analog of, just like there's a gravity to a mag, there's an analog of the magnetic effect in gravity, there must be some analog of polarization. And I wish I understood how to think about it. That's how to address this problem. And it's something you ought to be able to understand at least. And it would do just exactly what we want to do, right? There's no problem at all for general relativity on very small scales, nor would you expect stuff from this vast ensemble of super horizon things we've got created to do something on small scales. You'd expect it to be most effective on large scales, just by causality and a lot of other ideas. So it would be exactly what you would expect to do something on large scales and not so much on small scales. Okay, great. It's a big smiling face. How do I think, what kind of effect should I look for?
So I think that's really the question, and I think that theories among us haven't really done their job, or maybe they have and haven't been heard. So, but that's so the thing is the particle physicists have, I think they have done their homework and they have candidates to go after, and
so they,
as much as haven't.
The orthogonal empirical approach is just to try to measure things better and hope
that
you see something that's state.
Yeah.
But I think you guys are doing exactly the right thing. I mean, generically, just stands to reason that, you know, if you just engage in model building, which is what S. Nye said, and it's what everybody agrees is what's been done so far, then what you do is fit the background with whatever free parameters are in the model, and then do structure formation to break the degeneracy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we had insight from deep theory, that's got us to be right.
Good, okay. So we also didn't hear much about other anomalies. Maybe people are tired of anomalies. Although Dick Bond said at dinner that he is not an anomaly denier, which sounds like a double negative to me. I guess, does that mean he's an anomaly supporter? I'm not sure. You know, the axis of evil. We did hear about the asymmetry and the power, cold spots, super voids, and so on and so forth.
The context was that Kendrick was an anomaly denier.
I see. Okay.
He was one of the contrastants,
so. I didn't hear the whole story. All right, that's good. So, of course, one approach to dealing with anomalies is just to ignore them. So you can always, you know, face the other way. But in particle physics, look elsewhere has a different meaning. So when I talk about this with students, I like to show this cartoon, and if you haven't seen it, you can use it with your own students, okay? The look elsewhere effect, right? How do you quantify the significance of any given anomaly? So I don't know if you can read that from back there. This is XKCD, right? Jelly beans cause acne. Scientists investigate. Oh, but we're playing Minecraft. Oh, okay. No link between jelly beans and acne with a p-value greater than 0.05. Well, that's settled. Well, there could just be a certain color. Scientists, Minecraft! So we find no link between purple jelly beans, brown, pink, blue, teal, salmon, red, turquoise, magenta, yellow, green, mauve, wait, whoa, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, the answer is...
Was green up there somewhere?
Yeah, you missed it. We went through kind of quickly.
Oh, that's okay.
So that's a nice illustration. Of course, in the jelly bean case, it's relatively easy to quantify it, right? The problem is it's hard to actually do this calculation when you don't have a finite number of jelly beans. But yeah, so we read about it in the news, right? Okay, good. So I'm going to give you one example from my perspective, and then I'm hoping you can give me a few others from yours. When I'm wearing my cosmology hat, I'm interested in cosmic flows primarily, although also lensing. And the advantage of cosmic flows, the good thing is they measure this growth factor F, which is kind of neat. You don't get out of the density directly. And they also measure the matter power spectrum, and particularly they do it on very large scales, as Hume pointed out in his talk earlier. And they do so in the low redshift universe, as opposed to CMB and high. Somebody said, when I mentioned this in some comment, they say, you mean redshift space distortions. And yes, redshift space distortions are one example of cosmic flows. It's not the only way to do it. The classical way of doing, the old-fashioned way of doing cosmic flows is with a distance indicator, like a supernova. You measure the distance to the object, you measure its redshift, the difference between the two is the peculiar velocity, right? And that has the advantage that it has a disadvantage, it's noisy, but has the advantage that there's no cosmic variance in this measurement. It's a direct but noisy measurement of what you want to measure, right? So if you think about this in real space, if I know what the density field is, okay, and I measure the velocity field, I can figure out what this F is. All right, and there's no cosmic variance, as I said. There is noise, but no cosmic variance. It's like measuring, you know, if I knew the mass of the sun and I know the Earth's orbit, I measure G from its acceleration, right? It's just a measurement with one scaling parameter. Of course, it's a little bit more complicated because we don't actually know what this thing is. We know the delta of the galaxies, and so we replace this with the delta of the galaxies divided by the bias, and then maybe we want to write the bias as some ratio of sigma 8s. And so in the end of the day, you don't quite get this. You get some degenerate combination of F and sigma 8 of the mass. So Tully-Fisher, fundamental plane, and supernovae, we believe these for acceleration, right? So they should be good for this purpose as well. And we can measure this with redshift surveys. And we've tested this in simulations to do this direct comparison. We can get we've tested it with N bodies so that we get an unbiased measurement of this coefficient F by smoothing this, and it turns out, in case anybody's interested, the appropriate smoothing scale is 4 megaparsec Gaussian. And then this is just linear theory. You could, in principle, do better with nonlinear theory, but linear theory with the 4 megaparsec smoothing is good to 150 kilometers per second. Okay, and the coherent flows, you know, more or less random, the coherent flows are typically larger than that. So you can beat down the 150 with root N noise. Now, if you do that, you get a measurement of F sigma 8. This is from a paper one of my students wrote. So this is kind of an interesting plot. Different measurements of this combination, F sigma 8, but scaled to omega matter of 0.3, so it's not quite F, from different techniques. Okay, so, and they're sort of sorted by my guess of scale. Right, with small scales over here and sort of larger scales over here. Of course, all these techniques probe a range of scales, so they mix up. But it's what I'm thinking, what I'm guessing would be the order if you had to figure out what the typical scale was. So weak lensing, survey I've been involved in, measures a relatively low value of this. Various cluster abundance measurements, very tricky because you have to relate the mass of the clusters, which is what Preschecker or whatever gives you, to the observable you see, and that's very uncertain. They tend to, at least when we wrote this up, they tend to give a range of values. Peculiar velocity is what I'm just talking about here by this direct method. Older, that's some of our older work, some competitors, and this is the most recent stuff that we've done. Okay, and this is my estimate from redshift space distortions that was calculated circa 2012. So I was taking a whole bunch of redshift space distortion measurements of the same thing, including, I think, the DR9 BOSS, but not the latest one that Florian talked about. And the important thing is that these two things have similar error bars. Okay? So this is based on 6,000 peculiar velocities, and that one is based on nearly a million redshifts. Okay, so it's just trying to round the point home that one way to improve the measurements of this from velocities is to get more of these, because they'll go down roughly as root n. It's actually not quite true, because you go deeper, and the problem with peculiar velocities is the error scale linearly with distance. So as you go further out, the errors go up per object. But nevertheless, you can beat this down. This you can also beat down by surveying more volume until you run out of volume, because it's a cosmic variance limited measurement. So this is my promotion for doing this well, which has been hard because the groups that are doing this are small, with telescopes that are a bit patchwork, and it haven't had the systematic approach that other areas like Sloan and things have done for measuring redshifts.
So what do you need to do that peculiar velocity? So I guess you need a fundamental plane.
You need a fundamental plane or a Tully-Fisher or a supernova, typically.
So I mean, what would be Right, so couldn't you just do this with all the strong axes, or what do you need for all the strong
axes? I'll come back to that. That's the ugly part. Okay. Or is it the bad part? I forget. Probably on the next slide. So as we were discussing before, the other advantage of peculiar velocities is that they really do probe the largest scales, because the velocity has an extra k in the denominator in Fourier space. So it's weighted towards the largest scales. Hume talked about bulk flows. Okay, so one statistic you can measure, as he described, is the mean of a volume. And the RMS of that is some integral. And if you look at what this is and you plot it as a function of k, this integrand here, it peaks at about 0.01. Okay, with a secondary bump over here. And if one went to larger scales, the peak would shift to smaller k, of course. Now, this is some BOSS data from Ross, okay, and it shows you that the data is excellent, but then starts to get worse as you get to the close to the peak, and then there's maybe some systematics that you have to worry about over here. The north and the south don't, at least at the time this was written, don't look exactly the same. So you have natural leverage on the large scales. Well, I thought this was the difference of the window function, at least that's how I read it, that the solid curves were the predictions, including the window function. Right? So the two lines illustrates the, you can't probably can't read it, illustrates the effect of different windows.
Yeah, but they don't
include the leakage from the platform. Okay. Maybe you'll do a better job. My point is anyway, good data over here gets worse as you get over here, whereas this is naturally weighted towards larger scales. So here's another example of that. This is from Chris Blake's, I stole the slide off, found it off the web. Chris Blake's team in Australia, one of his students called Johnson, did an analysis of the velocity correlation function from a bunch of different surveys, including the 6DF survey and some supernovae. And it was able to extract a signal. It's a bit strange because he calls it F sigma 8, even though it's on a range of scales. But I think it's, you know, how much the signal is compared to a lambda CDM model with that sigma 8, right? And so you can measure it over a range of scales, including very large ones, which is nice, right? So maybe if there are anything strange, maybe it's happening on the larger scales, right? And maybe velocities is one way we could find it.
So is this anomaly the same as your anomaly that Hume mentioned, or is that based on velocities, right?
It's similar in the sense that it looks a bit high on the larger scales, but they haven't yet published their bulk flow paper. I think their number, from what I last heard, and you may know the exact numbers, something like a little bit lower than what we found if you try to do the same minimum variance analysis that we did. The raw, the sort of what I would call the more naive bulk flow, is a higher number, but the minimum variance one is a little bit lower, around 250, I think,
but
which wouldn't be a problem.
Just from local volume, but you can imagine like 100% microparsec region everywhere, different regions of the universe, and
yeah,
this is looking at all of those, not just our local volume. Am I right or not?
These points are from a velocity correlation function,
right,
so.
Right.
They'll presumably be some of the large, you know, in our language we expand in, you know, multipoles, dipole, quadrupole. This is presumably mostly dominated by those large scales, but may go beyond the dipole. I'm not sure. Presumably includes other things. The important point that's also worth mentioning is that the Australians are running a new survey called Taipan, using an upgrade of the 6DF. Instrument, which will be significantly larger. Okay, so the error bars will shrink. And I think the current plan is to go a little bit deeper, so they may also shift a little bit in terms of scale. So that's a step in the right direction of getting one of these homogeneous surveys and trying to do it systematic. But you got to really control the systematics is the hard part about this. And doing the whole sky as well, is an important. So I don't know if this is the bad or the ugly, but the systematics in this game are challenging. They're challenging in lensing as well, which I also work in, and I actually think lensing is worse, at least for cosmic shear. For galaxy-galaxy, it's okay. But the systematics are difficult. You know, if you wanted to go up to redshift of 0.1, and you have a 1% error in distance, which is quite easy to get if you don't understand your instrument, then that gives you a systematic of 300 kilometers per second, which is bigger than the signal you typically expect. So it's hard, and that's the reason why, for example, Sloan photometry alone is not good enough to do this. And why you've never seen a bulk flow paper out of Sloan, I assume, is because the systematics aren't controlled at this level. So it's hard. You have to be careful. But it's not impossible, right? We just need to be a large, well-controlled data where we're aware of these systematics and put in enough cross-checks to measure them and take them out. Okay, so that's my example. Other projects we discussed here, we heard about BOSS. We heard about Chime. Let's see, do we hear about any other observational projects that I missed that are current or in the very near future?
ACT,
right, of course, ACT. We didn't hear about some of the other well-known large projects like Euclid, largely to do gravitational lensing, but also BAOs, right, at €1 billion. We didn't hear about LSST very much. Also designed to do gravitational lensing, large-scale structure, no redshifts. And we didn't hear about WFIRST, which again has some of the same themes. So these are obviously big things that people should be thinking about what you can do with those. Sort of goes without saying, but if you want to join the WFIRST science teams, the call is out right now, and you should try to self-organize with other American groups. I'm not sure how you identify who's going to bid on this or who's going to compete for the science teams, but they are being formed at the moment. So those are big things which are going on, which, you know, the lensing will give us the dark matter map, right? I mean, I think Tony Tyson's name for LSST, oops, I'm going to skip through all the animation. And this used to be, I remember this used to be called the Dark Matter Telescope way back in the day. That was its sort of operating name before it was. So that's presumably pretty important for a large-scale structure, right? You'll measure the projected dark matter. We'll have, ultimately, have photometric redshifts first, and we'll know their distribution, right? And ultimately, for many projects, you want spectroscopic redshifts as well. Spectroscopic redshifts are going to be harder to come by, right? Because this is in the south. There's not much in the south that can do spectra of large numbers of objects. Only in Australia. All right. Okay. So just put these things in your head. They're big and they're coming. All right. So here's the more controversial part. Stimulate a bit more. Niash looks very serious here.
I'm gonna make sure.
You really get the point home. So should we all go home? Well, it depends if you're an optimist or a pessimist. And I have to admit I'm a bit schizo on some of these things, you know. Tuesday, Thursdays, I kind of agree with the statement. And Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I'm more optimistic in the sense that I don't think it's dead. So the worst case, the bad, is that, you know, we just live in a vanilla universe. With a bunch of ingredients that we don't fully understand, but we don't measure any deviation from some simple... I'm going to include the neutrinos now in the vanilla case. They're you know, a minor tweak on the picture, right? So what if we find the universe is flat, it has some CDM, the CDM is really boring, it's massive, it doesn't interact with anything. The dark energy looks like it has W of minus one, and the primordial fluctuations look like just a nice power law with some tilt. All right, what do we do then? Could happen. Right, I hope it doesn't. Better version, right, would be this model, which is the chocolate chip CDM model. So when we dig into the vanilla, we find some nuggets of goodness in there. It's not so bland. Okay, we discover some things which are interesting. You know, it could be curved. Maybe the CDM doesn't have such a high mass. Maybe it acts more like warm dark matter. That would be nice. Or it interacts with itself. Or it interacts with something else. Okay. Maybe the dark energy evolves. doesn't have W of minus one, which would be fantastic if we found that. And yes, absolutely.
I'm not observational, but I hear from the depressing people or the depressed people that that there's no chance, given the error bars, that in the sensitivity that they have, that they're going to be able to confirm that the power condition evolves. Is that true?
If you have the error bars will shrink, right? So they're already, you know, minus one plus or minus about 0.05 or something like that. This is the number that sticks in my head. So they're going to go down to some smaller number, 0.01, 0.02, right? So either you're going to find minus one plus or minus 0.01, let's say.
What I've heard from the people who are depressed about cosmology is that given the current, how close it is to minus one right now, and the current error bars right now, and the projected sensitivity of any probe that's in the pipeline, there's no chance that they'll get a statistically significant.
I don't think you can say that, because you might measure minus 0.95 plus or minus 0.01. And that would be very exciting, because it would be formally a five sigma difference. So we just don't know. But it's a bit like what Kendrick talked about, is shrinking error bars. So far, you know, the error bars have gone down and we've converged on minus one. So maybe if you were a betting man, you wouldn't bet too high.
So there really is a chance it isn't totally ruled out.
There will always be a chance, right? I mean, you can keep on measuring it till the end of days, and you can always measure a difference from minus one.
The problem is that there is not a target. That's the problem. And I think this goes back to the theorist's really homework, is that if there were
why is the problem that there's not a target? I mean, if right now the data was in tension with W is equal to minus one, then you could say, and if they were going to get very much increased sensitivity, then you'd say, oh gosh, there's a really good chance that we're going to be able to nail it. But if it's right now dead on minus one, then.
But that doesn't, right, if you're going to increase sensitivity by a factor of five, which is kind of what's going to happen in the next 10 years, then you may find, maybe that's, you're never going to get like a five sigma evidence, you're going to get maybe 2.5 sigma.
Yeah, but see, then people would just dismiss that. They'll just say, well, 2.5 sigma happens routinely in particles.
No, then they'll measure more and they'll shrink the error bars and see if the 2.5 sigma goes away or not.
Motivation, but the thing is, it's kind of a sociological question is, yes, if you don't see a 2.5 sigma deviation, I mean, some people claim that depending on what you look at, there's some data that have discrepancies.
Tell me what's discrepancy?
I mean, there are various things, like, I mean, I think what Angel mentioned, maybe informally, was like, if you look at lambda alpha forest by BIO at redshift 2.4, it has like negative dark energy density. So, but that could be some systematic. So the thing is that there are various, there are always, as Mike was mentioning, there are all sorts of, like, there are 20 different probes of dark energy, and like statistically one of them will be 2 sigma anomalous, and this might be that one. So I think that the target should really come from the theory, not from observations, because there will always be some observations that are somewhat anomalous, and that could be either because of systematics or just random. But I mean, the only target that we have is minus one, which for some reason is depressed. Maybe some people are very happy with minus one. I don't know. I mean, it's a choice. So you could be having a very happy bit or very sad bit. But if you had like two I think the ideal situation was if you had two targets, like minus one and minus 0.9, let's say, then you could definitely rule them out, rule one of them out.
Is there a target deviation from minus one? You know, like if you measure FNL less than one, it's qualitatively new.
Yeah. Exactly.
Plus one, if it's 1%, is it something positive?
That's exactly, I mean, this is where the theory is really lagging behind, because, I mean, for FNL, we think about nonlinearities, and GR has nonlinearities that naturally gives you FNL of order one. For dark energy, we have no idea. There's really no obvious target, at least none that is widely known or publicized. So, yeah, I mean, think you could. And I think all the models that are out there are kind of phenomenological. You could get anything, they could be anywhere between lambda and some random possibility. So, but yeah, if there's some target that could solve some sort of hierarchy problem, so I mean, this is the nice thing about, like, as I was saying, in particle physics, you have a target, you want to solve a hierarchy problem, you build supersymmetry, you build larger square dimension, and then you have a specific thing that you would look for.
So, but do you really think there'll be a target that's like minus one or minus 0.99? Like,
yeah. And like, I mean, I think the perfect example is what Richard mentioned. They had a model to explain the coincidence problem, and that their model is basically when the radiation domination ends, then dark energy starts to turn on, and then we would see something today. But that model was ruled out.
Well,
and
but see, that model never would have been ruled out or confirmed by W equals minus one, because that model has a free parameter that I could tune to set W equal to be anything. I can get it to agree exactly with lambda C.
That, your model.
Yeah.
No, but isn't the idea that you want to turn on dark energy at
absolutely.
At,
so
at,
it,
right,
it
cannot
be
exactly minus one, right?
It would have W equals, well, it depends on how far back you measure, but none of the probes are going to measure back to the radiation domination transition.
Well, I mean, you have
it's
to gonna,
it's
going to
look
that.
Indistinguishable from.
Okay, so that's your model.
So we would agree exactly with, and most of the models have free parameters that can just be tuned to get you to agree exactly with lambda CBM, which is why I can't argue against it. I'm not an observational guy, but when these people who are depressed about cosmology
right.
say there's just no conceivable measurement of W that's going to show a deviation, a statistically significant deviation from lambda CBM, I can't argue.
So there's another possibility, which is you forget about the models and we just go out and measure, you know, shut up
yeah.
and measure, right?
I think the
history,
is...
right, of the field, you know, and dark matter, who ordered that, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
oh,
Zwicky found it and Rubin, Zwicky and Rubin found it and then everybody started finding it and, you know, cosmological constant, dark energy, whatever it is, didn't really predict that.
Mm-hmm.
We found it by measuring things better. So there's a good chance that I think, based just on past history, that if we keep measuring, we'll either find one of these things or maybe we'll find something different that's unanticipated.
But I guess the question is, what should we measure? Because if you have a finite amount of money, there are all sorts of things you can invest it in.
That's right. That's
and
right.
That's right.
That's right.
Ideally, you would want to measure everything as
yep.
good as you can. But
so as we've said, the standard approach has been, at least in the lowish redshift universe, expansion history and structure growth, and compare those and see if they give a consistent story.
But I feel like Naish is arguing that we should invest in theorists.
Well, I guess maybe that's what I'm saying, yes.
No giving $100 billion to theorists. It's already been done.
Theorists can use a little more.
Yeah,
I'm outnumbered here. So anyway, this is what we don't know. And the ugly, I will leave up to you to figure out. I'm not sure what the ugly is here. I think that's most of what I wanted to say. But now is I don't know how much time we have. We had some back and forth. Anybody else want to chirp up with, you know, some of the Clint Eastwood questions, right? What's the most exciting thing to do? What would you spend your money on, theorists? And what are the problems? Is there any big flaws? Any major issues? That could send this whole thing tumbling down. I'm thinking, obviously, from my perspective, more in the data, in the understanding of the data. I'd be curious to know. And we can chat about that until we're out of time.
I was thinking about something I guess I have never thought about before, but if you really think that there's new physics on larger scales, then I guess, of course, that could mean different things, because, I mean, scale, I guess, this is cosmologies, we have co-moving a scale and physical scale, but I suppose there could be very different ways. You could have Fourier space, you have real space. So one thing that we haven't really thought about very much is, what is the largest physical scale that we can ever probe, given that we have a light curve? And maybe that's...
Isn't that the horizon?
Well, no, because if you go back to the CMB time, everything was much smaller.
Oh,
yeah.
Not in co-moving then.
Yeah, that's physical. So co-moving is the right thing to look at if you are interested in initial conditions, like if you have like remnants from inflation, like the kind of stuff that Matt, for example, talks about, or looks at like bubbles or weird things. But if you actually have new physics on larger scales, and it comes in on large physical scales, then maybe one possible target is try to probe the largest physical scale that we can. And it's not the horizon. It's probably somewhere between the horizon and here. And
Redshift 1, I'm just guessing.
I don't know.
Maybe
Redshift 6, I don't know. But then that's somewhere, That's as big as we can ever see, of course, if you have a finite horizon. So
yeah.
If there's something that's going to show up, and
Boss is already doing it, so, right?
And
Boss is already doing it.
Redshift 6?
No, Redshift, if it's Redshift 1.
Well, no, right, right. So the question, what is actually there? So this is one question, is where do you want to invest your money? And I think one possible theoretical clue is at the largest physical scale. I'm not quite sure whether that's the right answer, but that's something to think about.
It's
what?
In the angular diameter distance peaks, right? It's,
is that right?
I think it's like Redshift 2 and around 6,000.
Mm-hmm. Is it Redshift 2? Okay.
Sorry.
I think there's a plot in like chapter 1 of the Golden Sea, but I just forgot exactly the but it's wherever the angular diameter is.
I think it's a little bit more subtle than that, but okay.
But if things depend on redshift, like dark energy kicks in more and more at low redshift, then you're better off staying at low redshifts.
This is,
right?
I think this is an interesting question. Do you want to look at where dark energy is big, and that would argue for low redshift, or do you want to look at where we have large, very large physical scales? And I don't know, maybe there isn't too much of a difference.
Okay, other comments?
One thing that I would do is echo Nyesha's statement that the spirits really need to get themselves in gear. I mean, I hear depressing statements about the CMB that it's all parameterized by just two parameters or something. I mean, really, there's a huge number of data points available there. It's consistent with a very, very small number of parameters, but I mean, this is the first, if primordial inflation is right, this is the first quantum gravitational data that's ever been taken, and it would be a huge number. If we had a theory, a right theory of inflation, a theory of inflation that we believe, this is a huge number of tests of quantum gravity, and it's only going to get better. That's not anything you would observational astronomers can do anything about.
No, it's done, right? That's done. It's done, right? We know as much as we're cosmic variance limited,
yeah,
right? On
right.
Large
but,
scales, right?
I hear people make depressing statements about it, and it seems to me that they were hoping for features and stuff that they would see, but if we had a theory of inflation, if we knew that is the gravitational response to quantum fluctuations in matter, if we knew what the quantum fluctuations were of, that would be very, very sensitive test, hugely
yeah.
sensitive test of quantum gravity, the first ever that we had.
It's certainly, as far as I know, consistent with a pure featureless primordial spectrum. But again, it comes back to the question, it's like the W. If you had a specific signature that you knew to shoot for, then you could do a one-on-one comparison, flat versus wiggly. Now it's just, you know, flat with some error bars on it, right? People try to fit with splines and so on.
It isn't even so much whether or not there are features there, even if the actual result was flat. If we had a theory a theory that wasn't, you know, just craziness, fine-tuned to the nth degree, and that came possibly from fundamental theory, that would be an amazing thing. Then I look at stuff like the CMB differently than I think a lot of the other people do. I mean, they're saying, it's all just parameterized by a few number of parameters. It's nothing interesting there anymore. And I remember the days when there was zero hope that we would ever get any data on quantum gravity, when people actually still are writing papers saying that we can't, even though that's obviously wrong. The problem is that, I mean, this is a quantum gravitational response. The problem is we don't know what response is two. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, we were detecting the gravity of the solar system, but we didn't know about the sun that was causing it.
Mm-hmm. So, other comments? Do Yassine, Sarah, Kendrick, Chris?
So this is your chance to speak or forever hold your silence.
Until the next meeting.
Yes, I was told to mention that we are going to have a Cosmic Frontiers conference here next summer. So remember that. Come back.
Is that part of a series? Or
I guess
when you said
we have
it sounds like a repeating. thing.
You have, but it's rotated within 3 instances.
I see.
Years,
I see.
Yeah, so yeah. It's going to be back okay. here next summer. So if you miss our coffee, then that's going to be a chance to come back here.
Last chance. Okay.
So we thank Mike for taking this on.
And if any of you are observers and you're still here tonight, Perseids. It was clear last time I looked. Up at, I can give you the detail up at north of UW, which is only a 15-minute walk away. There's going to be a little party. The amateur astronomers bring out their nice telescopes, and you can see stuff. So those of you who are theorists and have never looked through a telescope, you know, now's your chance. I'll probably check it out. It's going to be a bit cool, but I think it should. Last time I looked, it was going to be clear. So ask me, and I'll direct you, or at least point you to that page. You can find it.
So maybe I guess this one.